is a special report.
Knowing how to invest your money is harder than ever before. Dealing with stock market volatility, record debt, and terrorist attacks requires new thinking. At U.S. Asset Management, we can help you see the world more clearly so that you can move beyond the chaos and invest with confidence. Call us, visit us online, or drop by our office. U.S. Asset Management, helping you make better decisions with your money.
If we have a financial crisis, one of the things you're going to want to be able to do is to barter and to buy goods and services, obviously. And if you're out of dollars or the ATM's down or you're locked down or you need a way to pay for something and maybe the current financial system just doesn't exist, check out these prepper bars. They break into little pieces, different grams of silver or gold, and you can carry them in your wallet, break a piece off to pay for whatever you need at the time. It's a fantastic idea. They're sold at cdmbar.com. Check it out and get some prepper bars and be ready. Thanks.
Hi, everybody. I'm Christine Dolan, and this is our Globalist in Plain Sight Sunday show that we started in 2022 because of the efforts being pushed by President Biden to put our national health security under the WHO. But today we're doing a sort of a special show combining that theme with going into the Republican National Convention starting tomorrow. And unfortunately, we're going to have a discussion today about what happened yesterday and the fallout from the attempted assassination on former President Donald Trump. And with me today is my colleague, Bill Quinn, and BKP. Welcome to the show. You're out there in rural America, which is, you know, exactly where this started yesterday in Butler, Pennsylvania, just out, you know, I guess it's south of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You know, last night before I went to bed, I saw that AFL had filed a FOIA to get some more information about the request for additional Secret Service detail with President Trump. This morning, Mike Flynn texted me and confirmed that, in fact, that the campaign had asked for more Secret Service. Bobby Kennedy has been refused six times by the Biden administration, and their response to his request, they have used the excuse that, you know, you have to be 120 days out from the election. I've covered every presidential election since 1980, and I know that to be it's a lie. You can't even say that it's a mistake or it's a misunderstanding of the law. It's a lie in terms of historical precedent. Bill, what are you hearing out there?
Well, it's very interesting. The vast majority of people now have got what's happened yesterday on their radar. Some have not seen the videos, and perhaps we can show a couple of those in a few minutes. But if people were not paying attention before, I would venture a guess that the vast majority of Americans now are paying attention. And from what I'm hearing, they're questioning things very, very diligently now. They're looking at it and saying, you know, how is it that a shooter could get within 150 yards, because we have a number of estimates now, 150 yards of the president and not be one question? Two, how could they get a weapon up on a roof without being questioned and detained? And three, there are reports now surfacing about people saying they reported both to the police and to Secret Service in their within their circle, hey, there's a guy up there. And now there's questions about why wasn't action taken immediately, even down to people that were stationed as snipers. Why did they not take previous action? So I know that's a big mouthful, but the American public is asking difficult, hard, broad questions as we sit here this morning.
BK, what are you hearing?
Well, one to go. Thank you, Christine. One to go on what Bill said. I have been in communication last night with a text message with someone that was in the crowd, and I think most of us have watched all around the world the one interview where they pointed out that this guy was on this roof well in advance, and it, you know, the crowd obviously was able to see that, you know, something bad's happening here or about to happen. So, you know, I don't think we can go with calling, you know, an assassination attempt, you know, just start looking at what were the failures. You know, I'm sorry. There's things like you don't have, these are not failures, or, you know, when you start hearing reports and we're going to look at and do an investigation on what went wrong. What do you mean you're going to do an investigation on what went wrong? I mean, going all the way back to Kennedy, going back to Martin Luther King Jr., going back to Ronald Reagan, you know, the only one that's not a president was Martin Luther King. I mean, we have enough study when candidates or former presidents are doing anything to know what the security has to be and how it has to be run. So to look at what went wrong. So one thing I want to say, thank you, Christine. I don't think we should go any further in the show without acknowledging someone's dead. And I tell you, I hope I don't get emotional. I really don't. But someone is dead here. Yes, we all thank you, Bill. I usually watch Trump's you know, his rallies at 5 o'clock in the morning, you know. So yesterday afternoon, I wasn't watching it live. I was going to get up this morning, come into the studio, watch the rally. Bill, thank you very much. Called and said, are you watching when it happened? And I went to it. But yes, Trump got shot. He got up again. He yelled, fight, fight, fight. It is the picture seen around the world. But a man is dead. Mm-hmm. And I just can't stop on that. As you guys get further into this, you know, I know some things they don't want us to talk about, but reality is, Christine, you've been covering campaigns for a long time. You know, every date has monumental. You realize after Trump is nominated, that official nomination, he starts receiving national security briefings. All right. So to me, I'm looking at another angle. I'm not trying to go out there on a limb, but I'm not a coincidence kind of guy in politics. This happens 2 days before a nomination. He's supposed to be getting security briefings starting after Monday when it's official, the nomination or whatever may be.
It's Thursday. It's the fourth day.
When he accepts it. Okay. But this coming week is when he starts getting national security briefing. This past week, NATO was in together here. They talked about Trump proofing. The world was talking about how do we Trump proof the world? I mean, we just got to be, you know, if we had a dollar for every time in just 1 year, one of these lefties on one of these Mockingbird media channels said, well, you know, he could die. Like Jen Psaki, you know, I mean, and I know we don't want to go there right now, but the reality is they provoked this. And I think Bill has the quote of what Biden said last week, was it, you know, it's time to put Trump in the bullseye.
Mm-hmm. That was, I mean, one. The other one was, you know, I just want to tell you from the bottom of my heart, Trump is a threat, you know, a threat to democracy, a threat to this country.
Well, you know, they refer, and they've been doing this for quite some time. They use the phrase existential threat. But let's be clear about something. Benny Thompson, Congressman Benny Thompson from Mississippi, introduced a piece of legislation on the Hill that anybody who's convicted of a crime cannot receive Secret Service protection. That was before yesterday. Last night, one of his aides, and I'm not going to mention his name because I haven't seen this, I've just read about it, apparently put up some insidious saying, you know, next time that they shoot, you know, take a shooting lesson. I mean, and then it was wiped off. There is an outcry of Trump now saying, let's bring the country together in unity. Biden, I think it's very interesting, and this is just my observation, people who have vilified Trump on the far, far left especially, some of them did not make comments last night. And then others did come out. And I thought, you know, Barack Obama was the first one that came out. I thought that that was pretty hypocritical because and hypocritical of Biden. Because these guys can decide whether or not Bobby Kennedy and Trump get Bobby Kennedy gets Secret Service protection and whether or not Trump should receive an upgrade in Secret Service protection. Because when you make these requests, you have to put forth the reasons why. And so they have been studiously and intentionally ignoring the specifics of the threats on Trump and on Bobby Kennedy. And that's the part that I come down on. When you have an heavy evidence, why aren't you protecting? So to me, that's intentional, because anytime somebody asks for Secret Service protection, in 56 years since Lyndon Johnson announced that they were going to have Secret Service protection for presidential candidates, this is the first time, I guess it's the second time now, Bobby Kennedy being the first time it's been rejected in 56 years, and Donald Trump. So that's something that needs to be investigated. What was the basis of why Mayorkas or the Biden administration, and a president can decide. I know it's Homeland Security that has rejected these the Secret Service protection increase for Trump and for Bobby Kennedy, but a president of the United States can do it. And there's historical precedence of that. When Teddy Kennedy ran against Jimmy Carter in 1980, Jimmy Carter's camp knew this was going to be, you know, one heck of a race at that point in time, because Teddy was on fire with his criticism of Jimmy Carter. And this was a huge Democratic leader going after a Democratic incumbent president at the time. And before he announced, the agreement was made, and it was Jody Powell and Teddy Kennedy's camp, and Jimmy Carter gave Teddy Kennedy in 84 and 88. It was the Reagan administration that gave it to Jesse Jackson. When Obama ran in 2008, George W. Bush stepped up to the plate and gave him protection. So, you know, sometimes you don't have to ask. Sometimes it's so obvious. So that's the part I think that needs to be investigated. Why did Joe Biden, why did Mayorkas, who made up this decision if it's not Biden or not Mayorkas? Why didn't they give him? Because we know at the DNC, there's a SWAT team out there, and I don't mean that literally, but there's a team at the DNC to basically take Bobby Kennedy off the ballots and to take Trump off the ballots. We all know that. So did they set this up to put these guys in danger? That's a legitimate question right now, I think. Yeah.
Maybe it makes sense for the folks that haven't yet seen the event in detail. Maybe we can show them a little bit of that. And then there are some reports surfacing regarding the director of the Secret Service, mm-hmm. and perhaps some choices that she's been making that may have weighed into part of this, let's say. So if it's okay, Christine, shall sure. we show, should we show the event itself? Okay.
Absolutely.
So this first shot is going to be just as he's speaking. This is about 8 or 10 minutes into his speech. We have a wider angle that will be interesting to look at in just a few minutes, but let's just watch what happened. And you'll see him grab for his right ear as you hear the shots begin to ring out. And so let's see that.
Said, take a look at what happened. Oh.
So shortly, just a few seconds after this, they've obviously checked the president. They determined they need to evac him out of there, and they're going to help him up. And you'll see that occur in some of his moves at that point. What he's saying is he asks him to wait, and then reaches over the top. And in this version, you can actually hear him say, fight, fight, fight. This is one more version of that. And then lastly, a very interesting photograph that surfaced. It might be difficult to see on screen, but there's the path of a bullet that actually got caught in this photograph right there. We don't know if this is the actual bullet that would have gone past his ear or some other bullet, but it is fascinating.
You know, this is such a sad time for America because it's easy to say, you know, we need unity. But then again, it's going to be rough going into the Republican National Committee. I'm wondering now if this is going to change the tone of the Republican National Convention this week. I know how the plans are, you know, well, weeks in advance, months in advance of who's going to be speaking. They'll change it at the last minute. But, you know, BK, what are you hoping that you're going to hear from the convention this week?
Well, I was on the phone. I was on the phone right before the broadcast with a delegate that is on the Rules Committee and the Platform Committee. It has been out there all week. Last night, you know, conventions, you know, you're done with your daily business with these committees. And it's time to meet other delegates across the country on committees and go have some drinks. So they had just settled in last night. They had just settled in. It was about 250, and they had just settled in to a bar there, a watering hole. And the president had come on, and the delegate explained just the feeling, not trying to parallel 9/11, but just the feeling emotionally that you had that day when you were watching that, of how just everything drained out of the room. Mm-hmm. And when Trump stood up in this room, and these are the delegates, and gave the fight, actually tears broke out. And this delegate on the phone was actually in tears to me this morning, saying, "Brian, they tried to kill him." Now, what I asked this delegate, I said, "What's happening now?" So don't want to sound as though there's no urgency, but Monday is business day at the convention, and they've been told it's business as usual. You were going to keep the whole schedule. They're not altering anything. As you said, Christine, you're 100% correct. At conventions, speaking slots jockey, you know, in and out, left right and right. So that could alter who's going to speak in the slots. But outside of that, nothing changes. They've basically been told tomorrow, that's when all the delegates check in for today. The delegates are checking in this afternoon, the ones that are not on the committee. And that's tomorrow. They're told, hey, when the media asks you questions, we're here to nominate our president. We're here to nominate Donald Trump, and we're excited about electing the next president of the United States and the most courageous president. So they're upbeat. They're shaken, but they're upbeat. It has changed the tone for a, you know, we're down to business. We're going to do this. But security-wise, it's noticeable already that the soft zone has moved out. There's a hard zone and a soft zone. I don't have the details of how far out the soft zone has moved. And there's already noticeable change in the security level, noticeable, immediate. They are on lockdown as far as security level. It has increased dramatically.
It usually is very, very strong at conventions, but I can see, I mean, this is the first time in my lifetime going into a national convention that you have an attempted assassination ahead of time. So I would suspect that the local guys are going to have backup. The governors are going to have to, in Wisconsin and in Illinois, are going to have to not play any games here.
Just one more really quick comment. As you well know, conventions are, you know, in general, you get your convention bounce. It's called the convention bounce. That's when most people tune in. Is like when people say, well, most Americans are not tuned in, they're not paying attention. Historically, conventions is what starts Americans tuning in to look at the candidates that they're about to be presented to. You know, we pay attention to this every day. You hear about the convention bounce when you come out of it. For Republicans right now, I guarantee you this will be the highest rated convention, the highest rated viewership in the history. I guarantee that. I will put that out now. This will be a historic viewership. You always want to come out of a convention unified, patriotic, and ready to go to the finish line. Sadly, this is what we're discussing, but this is actually what is going to be coming out of this. This is going to be the end result of this, of most people. I think both of you are already hearing reports where people saying, you know, I was on the sideline. I've made up my mind. So thank you for that time.
Yes, and also we're going to be having a juxtaposition of issues is what I'm hearing from people that are at the convention in terms of where Trump stands, whether it be on transgender targeting of children or whether it be on the WHO, or whether it be on Zelensky. 2 days ago, Zelensky addressed the National Governors Association, which I think was very interesting. So he's over here, you know, either saying thank you and I want some more money.
I was going to say, what is he asking the states for money now?
I think he was in Utah, right, Christine? Wasn't he in Utah? Yeah, he was in Utah.
He was in Utah. So I think that's interesting. You know, because, I mean, he's all out there. He's all out there. So that's a difference between Biden and Trump. And NATO, there's a juxtaposition there. On the social issues, Trump is not for parental rights being nuked whatsoever. So I think it's going to be very interesting because there's a stark contrast not only on international affairs but also on domestic policy as well, whether or not, you know, whether it belongs to the states or not. Even he's you know, has absolutely come out and said he's not for any mandated COVID shots in the future. If they do what they told me that they were going to do 3 days ago, and this may all change because of what happened yesterday, but I was told that they were really going to push on these issues and push it out there for people to see the difference of it. And I think it's going to be fascinating to see what happens. I mean, Trump is a showman. As I said last night when Bill and Todd and I were on, I found it fascinating. And I chuckled a little bit yesterday morning before the attempted assassination to see what the stage looks like. I mean, not many people would even think of doing that, but I've been going to them for so long. And it is a White House image. It's the outside of the White House that's on the stage at the Republican National Convention. So that's the goal. They're making it front and center. And, you know, I bet Trump walks through that door that they have on the stage out of the White House.
One of the things that's begun to emerge, and you mentioned it earlier, Christine, is this notion of security and should it have been different and who is ultimately responsible for it being the way it was. And we've got several data points that kind of lead into this. This is Kimberly Cheadle, and she is the Secret Service director, so ultimately responsible for the Secret Service. She's a Biden appointee. She came from the Pepsi-Cola company, PepsiCo, and what she did specifically there was something similar, but certainly was not leading the security of the leader of the free world. And notably, some of her goals seem to be much more aligned to DEI and that sort of thing than focused solely on security. I've got a short video that talks about some of her goals that came out last year.
Hiring. They're aiming to have 30% women recruits by 2030 and even allowed YouTube influencer Michelle Carre to train with agents.
But I'm very conscious as I sit in this chair now of making sure that we need to attract diverse candidates and ensure that we are developing and giving opportunities to everybody in our workforce, and particularly women.
That workforce will be pivotal for the 2024 campaign season, which for the first time includes a former president who already has lifetime protection.
So that in and of itself is interesting. We are certainly not saying that there is any reason why either gender should not be part of the Secret Service. But watch the experience yesterday. And this is after they get Trump off the stage. and watch the Secret Service agents that are then involved in actually getting him into the car. Watch their actions. Watch their apparent confusion about what to do. And that's my interpretation, but watch this. Many folks have seen both training videos and prior situations that the Secret Service has handled that demonstrate that they go through drills constantly about what do you do if X happens? What do you do if Y happens? What if they happen concurrently? And they are drilled over and over and over again to know precisely what to do, where to be, who's doing what. And there's lots of questions now about did they know that? And there's even questions surfacing regarding the instructions that were released to the snipers who were on the roof. We'll show a little bit more of that in a couple of minutes, but I wanted to get wanted to toss it back to you, Christine, and maybe we can talk about this notion of real security and was it actually being provided?
Well, first of all, let me just say something about female Secret Service agents. Joe Biden doesn't have any. And he doesn't have any since he was vice president because he swims nude, all right? And that's a fact. So people have to understand that when they talk about DEI diversity and anything like that, and I can understand, Bill, quite frankly, some of the panic that some of these people have with, you know, if you're talking about the women around there, they look younger. They may have been new to this, and not everybody has ever covered an assassination. There was confusion a little bit around Ronald Reagan in March of 1981 when Hinckley tried to assassinate him at the Hilton. So I'm not as worried about that. What I'm worried about is why aren't we going by merit when it comes to protecting the anybody who's an elected official who has Secret Service or any candidate. So, I mean, we got to up the game. It's not like people don't know that this is a volatile time. They do know it's a volatile time, but I'm not as worried about, people. They didn't know, they may not have realized where the shots were coming because you just showed the picture before. It landed on Trump's right ear. At the same time, the trajectory of the bullet was coming from the other side. So, they may not have realized that, there was a rapid fire back towards the guy from the sniper that was on top of the roof. My question is, if they saw the guy crawl up to the roof and if the sniper had his eyes and his lens on the guy on top of the roof, why didn't the Secret Service get Trump off?
That's a fascinating question. And
I want to know why they didn't remove him, because we do know that Trump has been removed even from the press room. When he was president.
There's actually a video showing that the snipers who were up on the roof behind him, who were apparently trained on the location that the shooter was at, were on their scopes well prior to the actual first shots. What we don't know yet, and there are some reports, we're being very cautious with what information we're bringing out, but there are some reports that they were not given authority to engage as perhaps they should have been.
That's what the investigation.
That's correct. That's correct.
And they may have made the decision until he raises his gun, until he shoots, don't do anything. Well, usually they take you out before you pull the trigger.
Got a gun inside the zone, right?
Mm-hmm. I know Bill's going to show this tape, but I'm glad this discussion went in this direction, because I don't have the qualifications to do an investigation. The Secret Service agents to me look like they were trying to recount what they had read in the manual at the training facility, but that's a judgment and that's maybe not fair. But when you get to the snipers on the roof and you see all these videos, which I know you guys have hours in analyzing this also, and I'm not an investigator, you're wondering why someone was able to pull off, what was it, about five shots? You hear about five.
You're hearing someone, various numbers, but 5, 7, 8.
Yeah,
like
yeah, but let's call it 5, okay?
Well, we know that 3 people got hit.
Right.
One died,
so how does somebody pull off about 5 shots when we actually have the video showing they have him in the scope? I mean, and Christine, you're 100% right. I know you follow this. And when you're waiting to, you know, it's just like when we had Sodom, we had, what's his name, Bin Laden or whatever, and at Tora Bora, all right? And we couldn't get the go-ahead. It's just like when you can't get the go-ahead when they had the guy at the gate in Afghanistan at the airport, they couldn't get the go-ahead. You know, really? Really, we couldn't get the go-ahead? Maybe that's possible.
We'll find out. We will find out.
Yeah, but you would think they would be given the, you know, don't wait. But go ahead, Bill. I'm sorry to interrupt you there.
So as we get into this, just listen for Trump's voice because he's still speaking. You can see him on the very right-hand side of the screen. And so you can see him speaking, but they are already trained on their scopes. They have obviously communications devices on their body that they can be communicating with the commander, and yet nothing happens until, as you mentioned, until shots came from the shooter.
And you know, that's a little bit old. That chart's a couple of months old. And if you want to really see something that said, take a look at what happened.
So. Work to be done here, but a lot of questions surfacing around why were they trained on this gentleman and did not take action to prevent the problem, to prevent the threat. Anybody standing or sitting on top of a roof observed with a rifle within range of the president is a threat, I believe by definition. I'll defer to the experts on that, but I believe that would be perceived as a threat. So.
All right, so I think let's go to a commercial break here, Bill, and then I want to bring in Dr. Erica Anderson, because one of the topics that is juxtaposition between Biden and Trump is the targeting of kids for transgender medicine and operations, and Dr. Erica Anderson is the former president of WPATH USA, and she has been a psychologist. And she has had patients who, in fact, are children and parents coming to her about this issue.
Tagen kit is something new. Can you tell us about that and what's in it and what it's for?
Well, the contagion kit is specifically geared towards a respiratory virus. It mm-hmm. includes some of the medications that we've been talking about that are well known to be able to treat respiratory viruses. And mm-hmm. importantly, it includes a nebulizer, a mm-hmm. way to aerosolize a liquid medication so that you can breathe it into the lungs. Mm-hmm. Again, these kits are not meant to replace your doctor or a relationship with a doctor. They are not meant for you to fly solo. We have telemedicine visits mm-hmm. available if you have any questions about the symptoms you're having. There is a booklet in there as well that supports and kind of coaches you through what symptoms you may be having from something. So these aren't meant to be a panacea to replace mm-hmm. everything in medicine. It's a way, however, for people to feel and to be prepared, to be at the ready, to be more resilient, and to be more immune from the sorts of intrusions that we saw during COVID, where your insurance company or your own doctor or the pharmacist or the pharmacy was refusing to let people get a hold of medication.
All right, we are back, and let's bring in Dr. Erica Anderson, Bill, if you can. Here we go. Dr. Anderson, thank you so much for joining us today. You and I talked briefly last night, and you were introduced to me by Jeff Cleghorn. And CD Media is absolutely committed to raising the voices of those to speak up against the transgender operations and the targeting of children. So give the audience some background from your perspective. because you have been a psychologist for how many, over 30 years?
45.
Okay. So you mentioned to me last night that you saw this movement happening and you know, gaining ground starting in about 2017. And I know that when I did some research last night that you had actually filed an amicus brief some time ago in the state of Maryland, because the state of Maryland wanted to take away parental rights and wanted to just push these kids through, you know, sort of like a factory to take the puberty blockers and then push them into cross sex hormonal and eventually the operations themselves. And you're against that. When you spoke out as somebody who had been the president of WPATH USA and been on the board of WPATH internationally in London, what was the feedback to you? Because, and tell the audience who you are from your experiences. It's very important because you're at the top of the game.
Well, thank you, Christine, for having me. And I'm sad to be following such a sober topic that you were discussing before we started here. And my heart goes out to the people in Pennsylvania. And of course, we want former President Trump protected and everybody to be sobered by these events. Having said that, this is another complicated and politicized subject that we're all aware of now. You arguably cannot not be aware of it, given all the publicity that's been going around. I've been a psychologist all these years, and I've seen arguably three generations of young people, teenagers, go through adolescence. We've never had a generation go through teenage years with the atmosphere we have today. I've been speaking about it and writing about it for some time. My first interview about this was in the Washington Post in 2017. And then there was an article in the Atlantic Monthly, very extended article, where I expressed my concern. I self-styled myself at that time as the naysayer to those who were kind of pushing I'm going to say trans identification, some say trans ideology. At the time, I was a psychologist at the University of California, San Francisco Gender Clinic. And I've been doing that work for some time, both there and in private practice. And I started to see some very worrying trends. The rapid increase in the numbers of kids who decided that their identity was different than straight or, in the world, cisgender. And these numbers really were inexplicable, given everything I knew from epidemiology, from psychology, and so on. So I began to be concerned and expressing caution, and my caution continued. I started to speak out about it, and when I started to go public about it with media, particularly in 2021, I was on an episode of 60 Minutes, and I co-authored a piece that was in the Washington Post saying, I think things have gone too far. Mm-hmm. And my then colleagues, pretty much told me to shut up, that I was not speaking the party line, and that who was I to question what was going on? Well, subsequently, my concerns, unfortunately, have been amplified. And the rush to medicalization, something I have decried really for many years, has accelerated. And I've been worried for a long time that kids are being harmed. Kids are being pitted against their parents. Very disastrous situation. I'm a parent. I've helped raise two children. And then a lot of schools around the country adopted policies of what I call parent secrecy. And these are, I've actually done three amicus briefs on federal cases, two of which have already reached the Supreme Court, saying that this is unconscionable that schools would decide make decisions about kids and their gender and deliberately choose not to tell the parents if simply the kids said, please don't tell my parents.
Yeah, to me, that's a predatory behavior. It's institutional predatory behavior, because that's what perverts tell kids when they rape them. That's what gangs tell kids when that happens, or they threaten to kill the parents or something like that. I mean, when I first, you know, became aware in the last 3 years, that was the policy. Don't tell the parents. The school's agreeing. The teacher's agreeing. Billy goes to school and he dresses like Sally and he goes home and he's Billy and mommy and daddy don't know. To me, that's just morally outrageous.
It is. It is. And we're on the same side of crying out against this. I've been engaged as an expert witness so far in a number of cases, two of which we've actually won. Courts have agreed with our argument that these policies are inappropriate and dangerous. One case in Wisconsin where the judge in his ruling cited me for 4 pages of his ruling, told the school district to basically cease and desist with that policy subsequently. And I've been in Wisconsin, by the way, since then, and received warmly by people in school district leadership who said, thank you. Thank you for calling attention to the problems. The judge ruling was very powerful. The school district leadership ultimately apologized to parents and changed the policy. And another action in California, of all places, where teachers sued about such policies, and a judge agreed with us. I wrote an expert witness affidavit there as well. And similarly, different judge, different jurisdiction, but this time on behalf of teachers who said, this is not right. You can't put us in a situation of lying to parents. And that's literally what it is, deceiving parents. Many of us have so much a reaction to that. Surveys that have been done since I've been doing this in the United States and Canada confirm what you know. Overwhelmingly, parents don't want these policies. Even the parents who have gender questioning or maybe gay or lesbian kids, they know it's wrong to deceive parents. And these policies literally institutionalize deception and teach kids it's okay to deceive your parents. I mean, that is a really dangerous enterprise.
Absolutely. Now, let me, I have this question that it's just, I haven't had an answer to this, and it's important. Back in the 1960s, John Money ran the sex clinic at John Hopkins. Dr. Paul McHugh shut it down in the 1970s because Money was, his body of work was found to be fraudulent by Dr. Paul McHugh. So my question is, how did we get 300 sex clinics attached to hospitals? And how did we get this business model in the last, 10 years? Yeah. Because I look at this as a business. I don't look at this as human rights or anything like that. It's a business. We have set up a business in this country. But how did we get to this point?
So I think a lot of people, whether we attribute ill will to them or not, believed that promoting care for gender questioning kids was to accentuate a human rights issue. They took it out of the area of evidence-based medicine, and they just said kids deserve to get what they want. And I also take strenuous exception to that. It's like anybody who's been a parent, do children, 12, 13, 14-year-old kids, have the same judgment that mature adults? And do they ever ask for things that are not good for them? So, the idea that we would just do whatever kids want, and that's what it came down to, I'm afraid, in some circles. If a child says they're trans, then they're trans, give them the medicine. And I've been very vocal about this. It's wrong. It violates the most, cherished practices in healthcare, which is individual evaluation of what does somebody need. And I've said all through my career, we should get people what they need. Every child deserves to be loved and accepted. But we have now this huge number of kids who are questioning all kinds of things about their gender and sexuality. And they're confused in some cases. In some cases, they're looking to these identities as a solution to other problems. And I can state emphatically, there's no evidence that affirming a gender will solve a serious psychiatric problem. There's now evidence that providing gender medicines for young people, minors, is not suicide prevention, despite the claims by.
So was this a marketing narrative that the healthcare providers in this particular area wanted to tell people, well, if, you know, you can have a dead daughter or you can have a live son? I mean, was that like what the Sacklers did for the one to 10 pain?
It's a perversion. It's a perversion of some information and disinformation ultimately, because the people who were citing that originally, and it was like a telephone, the telephone game where somebody says and so forth, is there were surveys done years ago. The primary one was completed in 2015 of adult trans people who self-reported retrospectively that they had had self-destructive thoughts and even made suicide attempts. Now, adults in 2015 are not today's teenagers.
That's right. Adults in 2015 did not grow up with the impact of the internet.
And social media and the smartphone and the banter in schools about, okay, what's your identity? It was a completely different time. As I said earlier, I've dealt with adolescents in multiple cohorts. This cohort is different. They also were subjected to the COVID-19 social experiment, which has done nothing but harm for a lot of young people, you know, deprived of ordinary social experience at school and in the neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. They resorted to going online. And a lot of what's been online is really dangerous. Scary.
Yeah. If I could ask a question, I seem to recall too that part of this game, part of the acceptance of what's been going on is the presentation of quote unquote standards that are actually not based in medical study or experiments. I think there's an organization, WPATH, if I remember correctly, that has espoused certain standards internationally. And if I recall, AMA or one of the key medical associations has actually accepted them as if they were real and reflected them outward to other physicians. Yet they're not based on study. They're not based on empirical data that's been done, if I understood correctly. Is that your finding?
Well, the landscape has changed. So it's important to acknowledge that standards of care have evolved over the course of time, and research has advanced somewhat. But what happened was in the lead up to the release of the current standards, SOC 8, there was some politicking, and I was coincides with the time when I was saying we have to be public and we have to be transparent. And what I did not know at the time, because I wasn't involved in the decisions, was there was some politicking going on from the American Academy of Pediatrics and from HHS, from Admiral Rachel Levine, to suggest to WPATH that they should make some modifications to the standards. Prior to that, there had also been some, I'm going to say, shenanigans regarding evidence reviews that were contracted for WPATH with Johns Hopkins, which were not included in the standards. Right about that time, I was also becoming aware of the evidence reviews being done in Europe. And I've been to Europe and spoken to the leaders in Europe. I'm really more of a European now than an American in this field, because they determined that the evidence base for medicines and other irreversible interventions with kids who are gender questioning was weak and did not justify puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, certainly not surgeries. So those evidence reviews, Finland was first, but it's Finland. So it was kind of like quietly off in northern Scandinavia, 2020. Then Sweden, 2022-23, I spoke with the leaders in Sweden. They actually made a severe pivot from advising to use puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones with minors to saying, no, we will only use them in research protocols in a very prescribed way for in extraordinary circumstances. So they started to practice very cautiously. I advised in many ways other people in America to do the same. And they gave me a version of American exceptionalism back, which is, oh, we don't need to pay attention to what's going on in Europe. This year, as Christine knows, there was a very important, huge report, the Cass Commission report. Mm-hmm. I've been in communication with Dr. Hilary Cass, who's the head of the commission, of course, very well-respected pediatrician in London. She just was given a peerage, which means made lady, you know,
House of Lords.
Yeah, House of Lords.
Does she get a seat in House of Lords, or does she just get a peerage?
No, she won't have a seat in the House of Lords, but she has got a peerage. Mm-hmm. So, which is rare, and it's even more rare than being knighted, if you know about that, in the UK. Anyways, so this report, almost 400 pages, the result of 4 years of effort, did multiple systematic evidence reviews, came up with the same conclusions that Finland and Sweden and now Norway and France have, that Western Europe has basically said, we're not going to proceed recklessly anymore. We're going to recommend that these young people get to a chance to work with psychologists, you know, have psychosocial support to address all the issues that are going on with them. And they're manifold. You know, that's very clear that this huge increase is a very heterogeneous group. You know, they're not all trans, in my opinion. They're not all likely to continue to assert a different identity than their natal sex identity. And so now we have juxtaposed Europe, which in my opinion has done the right thing, focused on the evidence and the science, made changes, and America, which some of the people in America are still willy-nilly saying, you know, if a child says they're trans, give them the medicine.
Well, we also, you know, when you referred to that, Dr. Anderson, you talked about the insertion of Dr. Rachel Levine. And let's be clear about this. She was fully aware that WPATH was thinking of, you know, let's not go full blast ahead and put these kids on these puberty blockers and push them into the cross sex hormones and push them into the operations. But I think it's interesting of the timing, because the Biden administration is hellbent. Okay. And quite frankly, this is pharma. This is a lot of people in the healthcare who make money, the surgeons, the nurses, whoever these people are, who promote this. And they become the healthcare providing industry that financially benefits from this is now turning into advocates for it. And I think she's number two. Is she number two at HHS?
HHS, yeah.
Right. So she's out there pushing this for political reasons, even though it's not evidence-based. I mean, somebody like this should be fired, because she's playing politics with kids' lives, families, because, and let's talk about the risk here, because I shared with you that I did not know until Jeff Claghorn had forwarded me Jamie Reed's affidavit, and Jamie identifies as a queer woman. She worked at the time in the Washington Sex Trans Clinic, connected to Washington University. And in her affidavit, it says that there is an FDA black box warning as of July 2022 that if you take these puberty blockers, there's a risk a child may go blind. Most parents don't know that. No. So the risk for the infertility, the risk of going blind. And then we have people in the United States from the political angle of this pushing that keep the secrets from mommy and daddy, handing out some of these puberty blockers, going to Planned Parenthood and giving them to the child. And that leaves the parents with the consequences of possibly having to deal with that.
Yep. Well, there are some horrifying, you know, we don't have a lot of data on the incidence of it, but some horrifying consequences possible from these medicines. And what's even more alarming is we don't know the long-term effects. So we don't know, for example, is there an effect on brain development, mm-hmm. these medicines? We know that there's an effect on, potential effect on bone development. And bone and brain kind of share a lot in terms of, you know, nutrients and so on. So there are a lot of unresolved questions. And that's why the authorities in Europe have made the decisions they have. I understand the new leader of the Labour Party, Stramer, has come out very clearly and said the guidance recently given to not offer puberty blockers to such children in the UK, we're going to make permanent.
Right. That just happened in the last couple of days. He has basically come out and said, we're not going to mess around with this. We're not going after kids. We're not going to allow people right. to do this, which I think is very strong.
Yes.
But that also should, I mean, again, this puts an issue about kids and protecting children in America right in front and stage. And I hope that, you know, I know that former President Donald Trump is against this. And Biden is 100% for it. So I hope this is one of the issues that they bring up on the stage. Brian, you want to jump in here? Because we've got to say, Erica, we're going to have you back. You and I are going to do a one-on-one for a longer version. I apologize today only because of what happened last night with Donald Trump. But Brian, you want to jump in here real quick?
Yes, I want to say, Dr. Anderson, thank you for your work. I appreciate just the opportunity to sit here and listen, and obviously not to change the direction. I live in a rural area, and I call it the never could happen here area of America. And we just had our elections, and this is not really switching gears, and we had three incumbents to our Board of Education that were moved out of the way. We changed three incumbents in our Board of Education in a local rural community. Parents are engaged, and they don't like one of the mothers that just became a new Board of Education member, you know, didn't care for the schools asking her eighth grader if they were suicidal and having these interviews with these children. I'd just like to ask a quick question. What we're seeing here in Georgia is, and across the country, is that they're putting counseling in the schools in a whole different way for the children. And we have situations, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I just want to learn. You are Dr. Anderson. We're looking at all across the country where they're putting in people that are getting a training certificate. They're getting a training certificate in counseling. And these are the people that are actually working with children that are asking these kind of questions. And they're not like you. I'm listening to you. I'm totally amazed. And they're not meeting with someone like yourself. They're meeting with someone that has a certificate. And I'm not disrespecting anybody that's taken a course. What say you?
So you're right. I've been in multiple times spoken up and written about the idea that schools are not qualified to deal with these issues.
Right.
For them to presume that they are is a serious misjudgment. Others have pointed out that the schools of education training teachers are really kind of ideologically captured, that they think their job is to raise children, you know, rather than teach them. And we have a long history in the United States of partnership between parents and children, certainly in public schools. And I think this partnership is in jeopardy by teachers overreaching, thinking that they know better than parents what to do with children.
Oh,
thank you.
Unbelievable situation we have. I never thought I would live in a country where parents' rights were being nuked. It's unfathomable to me. Well, Dr. Anderson, I'm going to have you back. We're going to have more talks about this. We're going to put a panel together. We're going to take this on the road with you and Jeff and Jamie and some other people that I'm being introduced to, because I think this is a very important topic, and people need to, to me, it is as important as First Amendment rights in 2024. Mm-hmm. I think it's very important.
Well, if I might, just one more thing. So I think all of us can agree we're motivated to safeguard children. And so when we discover risks to children, it's incumbent upon us to speak up and to talk about how to protect children. And I've been doing that all my life, basically.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Anderson. And Brian and Bill, thanks for joining us today. And we've got to sign off. So thank you to the audience for watching, and we'll be back soon.